Hello and welcome to the Crate and Crowbar. This is episode 148, recorded on the 5th of July. I'm Tom Francis. With me here today are...
Tom Zinia.
And...
Alex Wiltshire.
And we have... Actually, before we get to, like, normal news, a small bit of pod housekeeping. I'm not going to be on the pod for the next 7 weeks, because I'm going to Sweden to make games in a forest, in cabins. The cabins are basically just apartments, really. It sounds like log, you know, you think... Mm. Log cabins in a forest, but no, they're quite well furnished and nice apartments.
I was hoping for kind of, I don't know, like wool rugs and smoke.
You got Bear Grylls game jam.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if it would help. It's a weird thing because it's like, it's like an accelerator, I think, or you could call it a retreat where like a load of developers all go there and, it's kind of sponsored by like Mojang and Rovio and people, and I guess the idea of all being like in the middle of the woods is partly to be isolated, right? Like normally like a writer's retreat would be where you cut yourself off from the world and you can focus on that thing. But we're going to have the internet. And that's my primary source of distraction anyway. So I think it's going to be more about just like being near other developers and that'll be useful in its own way. In the wider games industry, there has been some news, hasn't there?
Yes. Some news surrounding Counter-Strike Global Offensive. And the fact that you can, there are many black markets that exist in video games around items, especially ones that you can exchange and trade. And this one, there's one for gun skins and stuff, and you can gamble on them, I gather.
Yeah. So there's lotto sites. I don't know exactly how they work. Does everyone put in a gun skin from their inventory and then they're all like in the pool and then just it picks a random winner or something?
So you, I'm not sure if they all work the same way. As far as I can gather, you have your gun skins in front of you and they all have a value, the value that they are. And then you gamble their value against, upgrading from those, skins to get more valuable ones, which you can then either keep and then they're transferred to your account, or you can, cash in for their value. Which is usually below the value that you've just gambled away.
And the specific the breaking news, although it was really old by the time you hear this, it's quite old today, is that two people who have done videos of these, of basically people record themselves on these gambling sites, and that's actually like quite a common kind of YouTube video, is like people opening FIFA packs. We've talked about that before, and just anything with an element of chance and an element of possibility of success is quite good YouTube content. And Pro Syndicate and T Martin.
I didn't know how to pronounce it.
I hadn't heard of him, but he's also someone with like a million followers or something. Have done videos on this site called CSGO Lotto, and then a YouTuber called For Honor or Honor the something?
For Honor, I think.
Honor the Call.
Oh, Honor the Call, that's it, yeah.
Discovered that they own that site. And they didn't mention that in the videos. They do, in fact, one of them, the Martin guy, specifically says, like, oh, I just found this cool site. And then proceeds to show himself opening these, or like doing these bets and winning big, of course, and getting massively excited and winning, like, I think one of Syndicate's ones, like, he wins like $13,000 in 15 minutes or something. And that's a bit dodgy if you own the site. And so, like, the video, the one that got popular is by H3H. Wait, is it H3H3? Is that the name of the channel?
Yeah, I think so.
Which is going off of Honor the Call's research and bringing it to a much bigger audience, because that's a quite well-known YouTube channel. And he kind of focuses quite a lot on the idea that those bids might have been rigged, which is, you know, certainly that possibility is one of the many reasons you shouldn't do a video of your own gambling site without advertising it. But also, like, it seems sleazy as hell even before that point, doesn't it? Like, even just sort of advocating the gambling thing to their incredibly young audience is kind of already quite unsettling.
So Steam's...
And then when it's also dishonest.
Yeah, because on Steam you can do all this at the age of 13. There's whereas kind of typical gambling...
Yeah.
Comes with much higher age ratings.
And it's, I guess they're piggybacking off Valve's own, because, you know, Valve also don't abide by, like, don't have to worry about gambling laws, because they argue that the things that people are gambling are not money. They're CSGO weapon skins. They're just purely a set of things. Probably in terms of use, Valve technically own them all. But And I guess these sites kind of piggyback on that and say, well, our sites are also not gambling, because if these aren't real money, then there is no sense in which you're gambling money. But that seems untrue.
It does seem to be some counts. Money going in and money yeah. coming out.
It doesn't matter what the item is. I mean, if you could gamble silver spoons, and the fact that you can cash them in, that it means that they have monetary value. Yeah. But it seems like the regulatory authorities have got an extra kind of layer of stuff to add to their legislation to actually allow them to look at this stuff properly.
Yeah.
It seems like it's definitely an area that should definitely be regulated, particularly because, as we've mentioned, it affects kids so much.
Yeah.
And that a lot of these people who are using these services are 14, 15 year olds.
And that's the scary thing about Pro Syndicate and the other guys' YouTube channels, because their audiences are skewed pretty young and incredibly kind of impressionable.
It's, this whole thing is so fucking bizarre. Like, this latest bit is just about the gambling, but then, you know, you take a step back and they're trading like layers of paint on guns that have no effect on the guns, and they're hideous as well.
Yeah, they are so ugly. They are gross. Like,
almost the more valuable they are, the more hideous they are. And they're all the things that I would have said wouldn't be seen as valuable by players. Like, you know, if you were trying to make, if you look at like the skins in Overwatch have different tiers of rarity. And the highest tier ones are often like a bit more extravagant, but they're also like super tasteful. They're like a unified color scheme, and they're like really stylishly put together. And they're the kind of things that you can sort of see why they think they're valuable, like a beautifully crafted, you know, statue or something. But then the CSGO weapon skins seem just incredibly garish, just thing upon thing, like layered on top of each other.
So I don't know whether it's just like purely aesthetics or like there must be an element of rarity coming in, like they're attractive, sure. Not purely for their.
I mean, appearance. Actually, I can sort of understand that because I find myself swayed by that even with Overwatch skins. I have to keep going back to that because that's the only cosmetic thing I've cared about in years. But there are some Overwatch classes where probably the default skin is the one I would have picked if you gave me an even choice between all of them. But because it's the default one, if I really like that class, I can't stay as the default one. I can't be like default Hanzo. I have to pick some Hanzo skin. They're all bad, but like.
See, this is why I never understood why the attraction of buying the Overwatch Origins pack.
Oh yeah,
because that put a premium. Like it was probably about £10 or more for a set of skins and things, which every other person would have.
Yeah.
Like, so therefore, all you're saying is, hey, I spent more than, I ought to have done as well.
It's worth it because it's the only way you can not look like Reaper as Reaper without having to unlock something really expensive.
Same for Soldier 76. Like, the skin you get is way, but like, Soldier 76 is the most boring character design I've ever seen Blizzard do. And the founding pack actually turns him into a more fun, interesting.
So I've got character. I got a stunt man as a drop.
Really?
Yeah.
Well,
Evil Knievel one.
That's one of the only ones where I look at that and just don't know who the fuck it is. Yeah. It's a stunt man in this game.
It's interesting, this issue, looking at how different games companies deal with it. So for example, Blizzard have been at war with Gold Farmers for a decade now in World of Warcraft, and they've very, very kind of seemingly aggressively chased down people who are using their system to create black markets and to generate profit from it. And I wonder if that's a moral thing, or more that the FBI might be more interested in money laundering as a thing as opposed to gambling as a thing at the moment. So what do you guys think about Valve's kind of what Valve's position is in this? Because it's very difficult. They could have anticipated this. Are they responsible for it?
Valve have their own little gambling-esque thing, which H3H3 focuses on for a while in the video, that like you pay for the key to a crate, and then when you open the crate, I didn't know this, but in CSGO, opening the crate is presented like a slot machine. You see all the possible things sliding by, and then it settles on one, so you like it acts as if you could have got that one. You were so close to that super rare one. Which seems like both that and the general like crate and key system, I'm really surprised that they do it, because it already, just that by itself, seems sleazy to me. And I think all the reasons it works, all the reasons you shouldn't do it, because it's addictive, and because people feel compelled to do it even when they're not being significantly rewarded. And it means that a small amount of content can be stretched a long way, because people can just get dupes and dupes and dupes and keep paying and keep paying and keep paying, so they know they could have got that thing. And that all seems like great reasons to not use that system, unless you are like starving for cash. If you're a developer who's like, oh my god, our game's tanked and we just need to scrape by, like, we'll do whatever. If a company like that was doing the system, I'd be like, all right, I don't really like it, but you've got to do what you've got to do to survive. That's the only thing that works. But when you're Valve, why do you do the sleazy thing? Why didn't you do the nice thing and just relax?
But I guess they can see just the sheer popularity of it, because it must be driving, you know, like, enormous amount of play in the game now, you know?
Yeah.
I don't really want to take the devil's advocate point, because I don't support it, but I can also see that a lot of players would be really angry if they took it out.
Yeah, that's probably true. Yeah, that's probably one. I mean, it's the same as true of gambling, right? There's a bunch of people who just healthily enjoy it as a pastime, as a piece of game design. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, both exist. The fact that some people are able to enjoy it in moderation without it being a problem doesn't excuse the whole thing.
But the comparison with Blizzard is super interesting. Like, it's the, you know, like, where Blizzard are this sort of, I don't know, they're like the USSR. You know, they're total central control.
Yeah,
you know, like, and they will control every kind of arm of the tentacle, you know, every tentacle of the octopus. Whereas, you know, there's the US of Valve states kind of just sort of, you know, letting everything go out to the market.
It's the free market, right?
You know, yeah, absolutely. Total mad free market.
It does, it feels like it also ties into their culture of being very data driven and very experimental and just going with what the players seem to respond to. Because they've always said that, and they've always kind of, well, certainly since like Half-Life 2, have been very like, well, let's just try a whole bunch of things and then see what people like. And I, as a journalist, I used to get frustrated interviewing them, because they're like, I know they're great designers there. And I keep asking, what do you want this to be? What would you like to do next? And, oh, we'll just see what players like. No, you must have opinions. And then if you're doing monetization stuff, of course, if you just respond to whatever works, then you'll gravitate towards the kind of most exploitative things, because that will... And in fact, they've done talks about like how they don't do the exploitative thing of having a fake currency system like Xbox do, and like, you know, most free-to-play games do, because their experiment said it doesn't work. Like, that was the explanation of it. Like, they didn't say anything about like whether they thought it was a nice or a nasty thing to do. They just tried it, it didn't work, so they didn't do it.
The hat economy generally, like the stuff they put into TF2 and CSGO, is a kind of extraordinary example of introducing a market to something and then creating value for everyone involved. Like, as a free market ethos, it's a like practical example of why it can work. But they're obviously, this is the darker side of that, and you can't have one without the other, it seems. Like, if Valve crack down on their own on this sort of stuff, they have to restrict their own economy that they've created as well, and I don't think they'd ever want to do that unless they were forced to, because as far as they're concerned, it means that they've got content creators creating skins and hats, and that's good for the content creators because they get stuff, but they're also generating stuff for the game, which also keeps gamers interested, and it's this loop of satisfaction.
And this gambling isn't actually affecting CSGO itself.
Precisely, yeah. It's like,
I think they have blocked the CSGO Lotto site. I think that
was a moderator. That wasn't Valve itself. Oh, really? And it's been revoked as of this afternoon.
Yeah, Valve are very... I think they're always on the side of not banning anything ever. And they want to make it as free a thing as possible. And, you know, they don't want to make a moral stand on... take a moral stand on things. I've never really seen them actually close down stuff if it was too bad. The only exception to that is probably the tagging system, where I think they came in and snipped a load of tags where they introduced the tagging system for the first time, and some of the most popular tags were like Hitler was right and things like that. Inevitably, because this is the internet, and you know, we're all children on the internet.
4chan got there.
Yeah, precisely. But they I think they did crack down on that. Probably because it's just the PR disaster there is just too awful to.
But this is turning into one, you know. You know, you can see mainstream press seeing this is something to get right onto.
Yeah, well, we were in an hour-long meeting talking about it today, like a piece of gamer, because like, it's a big deal and it's only going to get bigger, because this isn't the only example. There's a huge issue around kids gambling in games and stuff like that, and the negative effects of it.
It's going to be. It also feels like, I mean, mainstream media have covered YouTubers a bit, but it's always so far just been this kind of like head scratching, like, oh, this thing kind of exists, here's one of those people, I guess. And I feel like there will come a time when something specific happens with a YouTuber that makes the mainstream media pay attention, and that will be the impression that people just have of YouTubers. Like, if this is it, if this actually does flare up with the mainstream media, then just the impression of YouTubers will be that they're corrupt, exploitative,
And they're kind of supporting all the bad things about games that people suspected in the first
place. That won't even matter to the kids, but it's when the parents start hearing that stuff is when that that will really start affecting them.
It's been interesting to see, like, obviously, I mean, completely predictable, but like, these, I think Syndicate's something like, I think he has 10 million followers on Twitter. I don't, I think he's on something like
8 million on YouTube.
And anyone with an audience that large has like a percentage of those people are just zealots, right? And they will just support him no matter what. And so, of course, this has been met with like fierce resistance from the people who like these YouTubers and who follow them. And just, I think for a lot of people, just develop a really personal relationship. It's like their friends being attacked. And I don't know if the facts matter at all. Maybe they matter a bit, but they're sort of like, I don't know. It's curious to see how they reacted, because T. Martin went back and added disclosure to all his videos. Although even then it wasn't a good disclosure. It was this video made possible by CSGO Lotto, which still doesn't say he owns it or has any affiliation with it. It's just like, of course, a video about CSGO Lotto is only made possible by CSGO Lotto. But, you know, that was after the fact. And then he just sort of like claimed that that was there.
He's also saying that, that when he did the video, he didn't have a pressure despite being on the founding. Yeah.
So those things, both those things are things where, like, I'm just hearing that that's the case, and I actually haven't, like, thoroughly
researched
it.
So he's due to put out a statement today, any moment.
Right. But it's interesting, because that's kind of what you do if you have that big base of, like, several million people who want to believe you. You just put enough evidence out there, it just looks like, well, look, you can see. My side is true.
Yeah.
And it doesn't stand up to scrutiny, but then those people aren't giving it scrutiny, so...
Yeah, this one's going to roll on and on, I think. We're going to, this will come back over and over again.
These people are in a position of massive success already when they started doing this.
That's true.
This is quite recent. And the, like, Syndicate has been a huge deal for years and years and years. Must have been massively rich long before they started. So why do you do the sleazy thing when you're already rich?
Yeah.
I mean, this is, I'm not, it's not specifically about gaming or Valve or YouTubers. It's actually just a complaint about human nature. Like, just across the world, the sleaziest people are the richest people. Why is that?
On that happy note, what have you been playing, Tom?
I've been playing a game that Graham has recommended on this podcast multiple times. And to me personally, I think several times as well. And written articles about RPS. And I always ignored his recommendations until recently he wrote an article about it on RPS saying it isn't that good. And then I played it. And it's Concrete Jungle. And it's so many things at once that it's quite tricky to describe. But basically you're looking like an isometric view of a grid that is just empty land to begin with. And you place buildings on it. And it's like 6 squares by 6 squares. And each square is a building or a space for a building. And in the basic game mode, you are placing buildings on there, and they either improve the tiles around them, or they kind of collect those improvements. So basically, that the ones that collect improvements tend to be houses. So the idea is you put like a green down, and a green is a nice thing, so it makes you can pick a tile next to it and say, let's make that tile better. So the green being there is making that tile nicer. And then you place a house there to capitalize on that, and then you get 1 point. The green is like a plus one thing, and the house collects points. And then if you had like 6 greens, how many squares surround a square? Is it 8?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's 8. If you had 8 greens, you could place 8 greens all around a thing and have them all make this same tile better and get up to 8 points, and then place a house there and collect all those 8 points. Or you can even have the house already there and put the greens around them afterwards. And... that's basically it. There are 200 odd buildings, with like different patterns of what they improve and, or in some case, make worse. Some of them will like actually only have bad effects, only make the land around them worse. Like a factory will only make the land around it worse, but it gives you a lot of economy, and economy is how you kind of unlock new buildings. And then there are other ones where like they have a nice little bit of logic to them. So things like, I was looking at a restaurant, and it makes things on one side have more points and things on the other side have less points. And at first I thought, oh, that seems a bit arbitrary. And I thought, oh, no, I guess if you have a restaurant, like the front of the restaurant is a nice thing for the residents. Oh. And then the back of the restaurant is where they shove out all the garbage. Mm. And so it's roughly feasible that, you know, commercial enterprise could have that effect. And so it's kind of, there's a lot of stuff like that where it's like, you know, there's not a one-to-one relationship between, like, just from knowing a building type, you could know what it does, but there's some logic there. You can see that, like, just a beautiful statue just makes everything around it better, and a factory makes everything around it worse, and it's really cool. It's incredibly slick, and it feels like one of those beautifully polished, like, mega commercial mobile games where, you know, whatever you may like or dislike about Candy Crush, it's, you know, incredibly well honed in terms of like the experience, and it's just really satisfying to click on things, and it's, you're led into it really well and taught it bit by bit, and it does that, and it's on PC, so that I think this guy's made mobile games before, like mobile only games before, I'm not sure. Cole Jeffries is the name of the developer who does almost everything. He does all of the art, all of the programming, all of the writing and design, and so it feels super slick, and then it just never stops getting more deep and complicated. Like, you just, there's like a campaign to it. So you play what feels like a tutorial, and then it just goes on and on, and it's got like a story and different characters who show up.
Is it across individual levels, or are you building on the same?
Yeah, so you build, each level is like that 6x6 grid. Once you, oh yeah, the actual goal is, the reason you're trying to get these points is you want each kind of column to have at least 3 points in it. And once it's got 3 points, it falls away, and you kind of scroll along one and you get another column at the back. And so you can do stuff like, if you don't improve the column that's right on the edge and you improve all the others, so you've got as long as you like to improve all those and make them incredible. And then you finish off the one that's actually next in the queue. And as soon as that disappears, they all disappear in a cascade.
Like, I think
you even get bonuses for that. Yeah. And it's really satisfying to like make incredible columns, or incredible, like, you know, beautiful bits of city that just work really well. But as you're playing it, it's like, it's doing that, and then it's unlocking new buildings each time, and then the character is talking to you all the time. The first character is like this this lady who's, it's all voice acted. It just goes like far above and beyond what it needs to be in a way that, like, it's neither a criticism nor praise, really. Or I'm sort of impressed by it, like the amount of, extraordinary amount of work's gone into it. I don't know how one person does all the art and the programming design. It's also like an incredibly well designed game. It's so smart at every stage. I actually kind of messaged the developer to say, oh, did you ever consider making this mode work in this way? And he replied to say, it does work in that way. Oh, okay, so everything I can think of you've already thought of and done. It's weird that it just keeps getting more intricate. So you make those columns, you've got to get them to add up to 3 or more. And then that character is talking to you, a new one gets introduced, who's like an incompetent mayor. And this kind of intelligent young girl is trying to persuade him to like see sense. And then you unlock the ability to play as that mayor. And until now, you've actually been playing as the young girl. And the young girl's like all about the arts and about improving cities, making them nice and good. And the mayor is just incompetent, but also rich and privileged. And so, depending on who you're playing as, it has this whole huge skill tree of abilities. So as you're placing these cards, placing the buildings, you're leveling up an economy. As you're getting more economy, you're buying cards. As you buy more cards, you get more technology. Technology ranks you up the skill tree, and then you use your character to buy different, like, one-off abilities. So that, because the mayor is incompetent, but rich, he can do things like, at some point if you've placed a lot of stuff, they'll have a certain expenditure, and once that hits a certain threshold, now you've got to get 4 points in every column, not 3. So it makes the game harder, and that's a kind of inevitable thing. But he has a skill called delaying the inevitable, which means he postpones that for just for a while. And that's what they kind of, in some sense, is a waste of a skill, because it doesn't get any new cards, it doesn't get any new points or anything, but it just staves off that for a while. And so, like, and I think there are about 8 of these characters, all with a completely unique skill tree, with like themed abilities that match their personality and also the character of the city that they would develop. And then it introduces versus mode, which is the same thing, 6x6 grid, and you still place buildings, but now the 2 rows on the far side are coloured in your colour, and 2 rows on the other side are coloured in the enemy's colour, and only you can build in your reserve space, and only they can build in their reserve space, and then there's a neutral ground between you where you can both build, and you are trying to get more points than them in each column. So if they've got 2 points in that column, they're in a strong position. They're like, if they get one more point, then they win that column. And if you get more than them, if you got 3, then you would also win that column. And if you both have 3, you both get 3 points. If you both have less than 3, you both get that whatever, how many points you put in that column. But if one of you is winning, and you have more points than the other one, if they had 4 and I had 3, they get 7. They steal your points. And that's the suggestion I made to him, because I played it like I had a couple of rows where we had either had the same score or neither of us had won the column and we both got all the points that we played.
This is against AI or another?
Yeah. You can play against other humans because it's got every feature ever. you can play against other humans, but I was just playing against AI and I noticed that like the first few columns that went off, it was giving me, both of us, all the points. And so I suggested him, oh, you should have a mode where like only the winner gets all the points, because then it would be really... Be like Gwent, you know how Gwent, you kind of like you pick Gwent, a column to like, I'm just going to win this one. I have to win this one.
Yeah.
And then the more you double down on that, the more you have to win this one, because now if you don't, you're just fucked.
Yeah.
And then it turns out it does work like that. And not only does the winner get, not only is the winner the only one who gets the points, he also gets all of the enemy points as well. So the more heavily you invest, the more points you're giving away. And it also means you can have a situation where, and I've had this several times, you put a bunch of points into a column and then the AI just has like some master stroke and they pull just ahead of you, so they got 4 and you've got 3, so you're both going to win, but he's going to take all your points. And then you realize, well, I can't actually get ahead of him, I can't get 5, I can maybe get 4, but what I can do is I can place some like a shitty factory next to his stuff and debuff it and it'll take him down. Or maybe you can't get anywhere near his buildings, but then you realize like, well, if he's going to get all my points, I could just tank my own points. So you could just build a factory in your reserved space, like shitting up all your own buildings, because it's going to reduce your score on that column enough that he will lose those points instead of gaining them, and be totally fucked. And the versus mode is like, so, you know, it's already getting quite complicated, that game, and not in like a messy way. It's really elegant. It chooses one thing at a time. You fully understand each thing before you move on to it. But it becomes just incredibly deep. There's just so much to think about, so many decisions going into everything. And then versus mode is just that times two, because now everything, all that stuff that just debuffs territory, that used to be so simple. It was just like, you just don't want to use it. Or if you're going to use it, put it in the corner and just forget about it. Now that's your attacks, and that's how you deconstruct the enemy territory. You like try and fuck up their side of the street. And it's also incredibly like personal. It's like super stressful to play. It's really because it's such a deep game, every decision, it just takes me like minutes to place every building, and you have to fill, I think, default game length is like 60 columns, so 60 times 6 buildings. Potentially you can progress by placing less than that if you have enough points, but like a one versus game, a normal like single player game match will take me like 10-15 minutes. A versus game will take me at least an hour, because it's just intense thought. And when you have a plan and you go for it, and then on their turn they just do something like out of the blue you didn't know they could do, it's just heartbreaking. Like, it's one of the only turn-based games I've rage quit. fuck this. And also, although it is good at explaining its rules, if there is a single rule you don't understand, you are fucked. It will lose you the whole game. I just did something where I had one thing where I placed a market garden next to farmland, and I thought a market garden was like a farmhouse, but it's not. It's like farmland. And so I boosted points instead of collecting points and ended up with no points and lost me the game. And then another time one time I just misclicked, like there's a little icon in the bottom left-hand corner that looks like a deck icon, and I thought I could review what the rest of my deck was. And by clicking on that, it just placed the building I had selected in the nearest slot it could, which is miles away from my cursor. And if you place a building in the wrong place in a versus game, you're fucked! The game is over! You can't recover from that. It's just always fatal. There's nothing you can do. You don't do everything, at least intelligently. It doesn't have to be the perfect move, but you have to have, every move has to be considered. You place one building in the wrong place, you've lost that super valuable building, you've ruined that space, you've failed to capitalize on the like crucial advantage that you're in the middle of working on. And then every now and then, like the businessman, the mayor, who's corrupt, he has one of his abilities called Invert, and it just flips the points of a tile. So if you have, like, if you just have a +1 and he does it, then you know, you've got a -1, you're going to lose that column. That's enough to lose that column, but it's not so bad. But if you're, like, winning a column and, you know, let's say you have that situation where, like, he's got 4 and you've got 3 and then you race ahead of him and you get 5 and now you're already happy because you're going to get 9 points because you're winning. And then he inverts your 5. Now you've got -5 and you're going to lose all 5 of those points. instead of gaining 9 points. So that's like 14 points difference. And sometimes the final score will be like 30 to 20 or something. So that's just, it's the end of the game. Like, there are so many things that are just such good plays or such terrible plays or such crucial mistakes that you just can't go on. I had one game where like I thought I'd had this really elaborate plan going on. And then the thing that tripped me up was that he just, you know, I was saying before, if the sort of current column, the oldest column, is completed, then it disappears. If it's not completed, then you can just carry on working on everything else and nothing changes. And I'd just forgotten that that column was still in play and that he, you know, you get three placements each on your turn. So on his turn, he could fill in the three blank spots it has and they have no points, but it would just resolve that column. And then all the columns behind it were already resolved. He already had a lead in most of them, or I had a lead in one of them. But the thing I was trying to set up was to steal his lead in this other column. And I put so much work into it. And I was like 1 point away from overtaking him. And because he just forced the issue. He hadn't got a lead. He hadn't improved his lead or taken any of my points. He just made it so that all the columns were resolved now. I lost all the points I'd invested instead of gaining all the points he'd invested. And at the time, it was totally devastating. I rage quit. And then when I came back to it, I realized we're actually just neck and neck now. It's like halfway through the game, we're neck and neck. But it's so emotional and so dramatic that at the time, there was no way I was going on. I was just, fuck it, I can't do it. I've lost everything. My life is over. And then you come back and like, oh, we're neck and neck. And we've got 40 columns to go. I can win this.
I love that they've created so much drama out of a game about adjacency bonuses.
Yeah, I really need to kind of figure out why it feels so brutally personal. I talked to Graham about it now that I know the game, and he says he actually stopped playing when he got to the versus things, just found it brutally difficult. It is brutally difficult. It's like 10 times harder than the single player stuff. Well, it's all single player, but
just because of the sheer number of extra variables.
It's kind of the AI is, the AI just knows everything, I guess.
Amazing that the AI works so well given that it's such a complicated game.
And I know I'm reading way too much into it, but I see things where like he doesn't do an obvious move and I'm like, shit, why didn't he do that? It seems like, oh my god, he's got something cool. Oh shit, he's gonna play me. If I take that column, he's gonna flip it on me. And sometimes he does. And
You're calling the AI he as well.
Funny enough, this is probably some terrible latent sexism, but I found myself doing that even when he's playing a female character. I always say he, because I talk out loud the whole time I'm playing, because it's so complicated that you can't leave anything in your head. You have to get it all out there. Like, okay, why is he doing that? He's doing that because of this. But if I go there, then I could take away a hit point from there. But I could just take away a point from that column. But that column, I don't know if I'm going to win it. And if I don't win it, then he gets all my points.
It sounds fucking exhausting.
Yeah. It's funny how like such a sort of fundamentally glowing, it's one of those sort of reviews or something where which is fundamentally glowing, but you kind of go, I don't want to play that.
So you can just play, you play the campaign. Unfortunately, it puts versus missions in it, and I think you can't progress until you do at least a few of them. But you can also just play the game in custom mode, and by the time you hit versus, you've learned, I think probably, hopefully, everything there is to know about the basic mode. And then you can just play that basic mode as a custom game, as a one-off thing. And that's just really addictive and just really satisfying. And it doesn't have that feeling of being overly personal, because no one fucks you over. You can only fuck yourself over. And it's also quite easy in general. I don't think I've ever had a non-versus game that was difficult, or certainly I've never lost one. Mm. And I think just once I had a column that didn't add up to three. And that's like there's an inbuilt mechanic for that. You just lose a life and there's ways of gaining new lives, and I hadn't even paid attention to that system because it never happened until that point. So like the basic game is just a really good hesitate to call it a casual game, but it's like the polish of a casual game with the depth of like a it is a deck building game. Like those buildings you place are technically a deck, and you build a deck before. Oh yeah, in addition to choosing your character, you also completely customize your deck if you want to. Like I say, there are over 200 cards, and also there's like a persistent unlock system, so that everything you do, whether you play custom games or versus or the campaign, is getting your points to reach a new level. And when you reach a new level, you unlock new cards that you can put into your deck.
I do really want this on iPad, actually. I feel like a 12-hour flight.
It sounds like it should be.
Yeah.
I wonder if it is. I think his last game was. But yeah, it's an amazing achievement. I can't believe it exists. And it feels like Cole Jeffries has, like, clearly all the skills you need to make a game. He obviously has used voice actors, and I think he's licensed some music. I don't know if it has any original score, but it has licensed music, and there's a, like, quite cleverly, checkbox on the main screen that says, if you're streaming this game, check this, so that we don't play any licensed music that will get a copyright claim against it. which is really smart.
So it's got every single feature.
Yeah, exactly. And that's
really clever.
Yeah.
That's really good. Yeah. Rambling.
But I feel like the one role he hasn't done for himself is like an editor or a producer.
Yeah.
They just say like, it's not that what you're doing isn't brilliant. It's just that you probably don't need to do that. You probably just skip 10 of these features and...
tell you what, put that in a sequel.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Versus Mode could have been a whole separate
thing. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well.
And I would have happily bought it.
I'm definitely playing this. Sounds great. Alex, what have you been playing? Loads of shit, I hear.
Well, yeah. So I've been playing... kind of everything and yet nothing because I finally finished upgrading my computer and I put a new graphics card in it. Hmm. One of them newfangled ones. That goes
which one was it? Just the
it is a NVIDIA 1070.
Four.
Yeah.
Four.
I thought, Tom, that it was going to make everything like amazing and better.
Mm.
And like it's faultless. Like it's amazing. Everything runs at perfectly smoothly all the time.
Yeah,
but games haven't got better.
No,
what's all that about? Yeah,
a little bit.
I've been playing The Witcher a lot over the last few. Oh, I don't know. Feels like a lifetime.
Yeah,
a great, wonderful, wonderful lifetime. And it's just been sort of stuck in 30 frames a second all this time, which has been perfectly fine.
Yeah.
Now it's not. It's much smoother, and yet it's totally just The Witcher. Still.
Yeah.
Which is nice as well because, you know, it hasn't changed. But, there is that little emptiness in the upgrading kind of
Yeah, the playing cycle. Crisis for 5 minutes and then it's like, yep.
So Ritual playing a crisis.
I went through a lot of games. Kind of just like, oh, that's what it looks like in Ultra, right?
Yeah, right.
5 minutes, up. Next one.
There's something that says that you look at graphics for 10 minutes and then if you're already into the game, the rest... it kind of fades to the background and that becomes the accepted level of detail. Obviously, I spend loads of money on graphics cards and just to do it but out of some kind of weird compulsion that I don't understand, but maybe I won't. Maybe I'll stick with my 970 for a decade.
I think my exception to that is game you've also been playing Far Cry Primal.
Yeah, so that was well, like my old graphics card probably wouldn't have been able to handle it because it's never done the Far Cry games that well. I love 2. I love 3. I bounced off 4 just completely. I don't know what it was. I just totally bounced off it. I think I was just UB map-itis. I think I just felt really tired about another map to fill. So I kind of, when Primal started getting previewed and things, I sort of, the owl. I was like, what on earth is this? And, you know, I just didn't get it. I did not get it. And like, you know, and then I saw Tom's screenshots. He was of these incredible valleys and beautiful colour schemes and trees. And so I tried that out. I downloaded it and it is really nice. I really like it. So everything else I played for about 5 minutes each. That one I've sunk much more time in.
Awesome.
And it's just like Far Cry. My experience of the previous games was really scatty. You know, you kind of zip into somewhere and then you're out and everywhere kind of looks the same. And I don't know, I didn't really get a feel for places in the previous games. But in this one, you know, I just go on these journeys. Like it's so nice. And, you know, and because time of day affects your experience of a place so much, it's just, you know, and you're walking through these forest glades and you suddenly crest the hill and there's a valley before you with all these incredible creatures in them. And then as saber-toothed tiger comes along and kind of kills some Neanderthals and like, it's just like really, really lovely.
This is, it's fascinating because you bounced off Far Cry 4 and I did as well because it felt too similar to 3, even though it's still a great game.
Yeah.
And yet, Primal kind of uses the same, not the same map, obviously they've redone it aesthetically, but structurally it's the same map, isn't it?
Mm.
And to have such a different experience.
You'd never know. It's such a weird, there was quite a fuss about it when that was revealed, and I was deep into Far Cry Primal right when that happened, and I was just like, I can't
you'd never
imagine
know.
Caring. Like, it's just a totally abstract concept to me. It's like if you said, oh, all of this is secretly the same colour as Far Cry 4. Well, I don't know what that means. Like, nothing I'm seeing relates to Far Cry 4.
And I think, yeah, it's quite a naturalistic environment anyway. So, I mean, you know, it's really hard to memorise places in Primal and from what I remember of Far Cry 4 because it's hills and, you know, it's just nothing to really peg onto. So, yeah, you'd... just seems, yeah, totally redundant that they did that. I mean, I was just, that's good though, being efficient. Good. Yeah. They put some time instead into actually really mixing up Far Cry. It's like, you know, I'm sure you talked about it when you were, on the podcast when you were playing it, but, you know, making you so grounded and making everything close up because you can only do things as far as you can throw a bow at them. Mm. There's no sniping. And it's, well, I suppose they're actually...
Throw your bow.
I think there's a long bow, which I think zooms in a little bit. So,
yeah.
But I don't think that it's really going to change the scale at which you fight much.
No.
And, you know, and your view is generally constricted because you've got such a lush kind of vegetation around.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And you're constantly turning around and you're seeing, you know, this kind of discrete new location that was right next door to where you were, but unknowingly. Yeah. It feels, everything's really close together, really intimate feeling, really kind of earthy, you might say, which is very fitting.
That's I love how wild it is.
Yeah.
It's like, it's just teeming with life, and that stuff, you sort of have to care about it as well, like, because a lot of it would attack you.
Yeah, it feels really dangerous. Although that closeness of life, so it feels like you're in a playground a lot of the time. So you kind of think about, like, sort of prehistory Earth, or, you know, like prehistory Europe, which I think is where it's meant to set, and you know, sort of like where man, you know, humankind is spread out across, you know, and they're hunting and they probably don't see each other for days. Here, you're hearing shouting all the time. It's like you're living in a kind of really, really violent neighborhood, like with all these voices kind of shouting and screaming all the time.
Fantastic.
So it's a really busy, really busy place.
I enjoy that too, because it's whenever someone is yelling, something's going on. Like you run to investigate a yell and it will be most often a tribe fighting an animal, like, or you watch the tribe hunt some dogs or something, and then they'll get attacked by a bear while that's happening. And then while they're fighting a bear, another tribe shows up, but it's an enemy tribe. So they start fighting the tribesmen and the bear, and the bear catches fire.
And then a mammoth turns up and just sort of whacks them all.
Can you can tame animals, is that right, in this game?
Yeah.
You sort of wave at them and they...
Yeah, it's the process for doing that is pretty lame. You just, like, throw some meat down and then they eat the meat and you just press a button on them and now they're yours forever.
Is there any... Like, I haven't noticed. Like, I managed to get a very fierce kind of lion, a cave lion, and it was no more challenging to do than a dog.
Oh, no, yeah. The taming process is, I think, the same. There are some legendary creatures where there's a special quest to tame them.
Okay.
And they are, like, better... But to be honest, I stopped using the pets because they just make the game so easy. Like,
yeah.
Your combat just becomes trivial. Stealth is now too unreliable. Even if you have a stealth-focused pet, it will just sometimes be seen by the enemy and just count against your stealth.
Which pets are stealth-focused as opposed to...
A black leopard, I think, is the stealth king.
Yeah, I think there's
like, cats generally are stealthy. Dogs, I wish they're... Yeah, I wish that system worked better for me, because I think I want them to be less on a power spectrum, because like the early ones are just shit and the later ones are just incredible. Both sides of that are bad. Like, I want my pet to be just always roughly the same power, and then to pick one based on like what animal I like and also on its special abilities, because they have different abilities. And the dogs, so cats are stealthy. Dogs will run and fetch things for you. So they go over to bodies and like search them for you and then bring you the stuff back, which is really cute and nice. But it doesn't matter because the dogs are shit.
Yeah, just quite
bear or cat.
Yeah. But they are, like, you can pet them and they've got this like incredibly furry face looking up at you, and it's heartbreaking.
Can they die, or like Far Cry 2, do they deploy a flare?
You can.
That you then have to go back.
That would be great.
It's weird, like, Save me! You kind of develop. I did, like, you know, the first wolf that I had, like, I did kill it, and you can just go up and revive it if you get it in a certain time. If you don't get there in a certain time, it just dies, but then you can call one immediately back.
Oh, right.
You can swap it from a little menu. I mean, I believe that most cavemen had that at the time.
That's hilarious.
I think the main, like, I would just love it if taming an animal was like, I actually really like the way taming works in World of Warcraft, where you have to have a fight with the animal and you just have to sit there and take it. Like, fight you and you just don't know anything about it. You just say that you're channeling your taming spell or whatever, which is makes no sense. But they're just like, my pink flamingo that I tamed was, I was like, still remember just standing there and letting it claw me and claw me and claw me, going lower and lower in health. I'm like, oh shit, can I take this? And then eventually they just kind of calm down and then just like, okay, now we have a relationship. This is how it works. I wish, like, in Far Cry, I'd almost like to have to, like, leave the animal all the way back to my village or something and then keep it in a cage for, like, a, you know, a day or something, and then visit it and feed it all the time, and then eventually it comes to trust me, and then it's my pet. And then if it dies, it's gone forever. And then that, you'd be so invested in that. Yeah. That would be so much more.
Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. I think there is an element of where you have to sort of hunt the one that you like, because it's quite tricky to get them to get attracted to the meat you put down. But I haven't played enough to really. One thing I'm suspect, given it's Far Cry, it'll do a little bit of an about face on this. But at the moment, I'm early in the game, and we very Homo sapiens kind of style cave people are against the flesh eaters, the Udam or something like that, and they are evidently Neanderthal. And there's something. I mean, I think that it's going to do an about face on this. We're going to discover that they're all kind of, they are actually quite sympathetic, but at the moment they are evil, brutish kind of brutes who kind of don't deserve, who get killed in enormous quantities.
Smash up the lesser species, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Which is very much counter to modern scientific thinking.
Yeah, interesting that. But Far Cry always has it. Like, Far Cry has always been about wading into a situation you do not understand and just killing people almost at random based on like a tiny amount of information, especially like three.
It's like, impressive that they managed to actually port that ethos all the way back into the major and we don't even recognize it.
Yeah, they managed it. Brilliant.
I didn't really see them as like different. I didn't notice the physical differences so much. I just noticed they had red on them a lot, so they were and then later on there's blue enemies.
They're blue ones, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And they like fire.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. What have you been playing, Tom?
I've been playing, for no reason I can discern, Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning.
Wow.
I know. Wow. Right? That was from the left field right there. Didn't expect that.
That's a big game. I got so frightened of it because it's so big.
Enormous. But it's really fun in a completely disposable way, which is absurd because it's a very disposable fun thing that is like 250 hours long. So those two factors.
You can dispose of 250 hours very easily.
Yeah. And for some reason, I bought all the expansions in the Steam sale. So I thought this would be a rolling project. I'm going to get to the fucking end of Kingdoms of Amalur before I die. And it's got some fun, like pirate DLC, and the DLC is supposed to be generally quite good. But as a kind of throwaway RPG, it has really strangely satisfying combat, where it's a third person thing where you've got a lot of different weapons, and it's probably closest to God of War in a lot of ways. It does the Zelda thing where when you hit something, it registers hits by freezing for a frame or two, which is that you don't really see that very much anymore. And so much of the game is a throwback in the same way. And particularly, like, for the last few years, have you seen anyone standing underneath a giant yellow exclamation mark ready to give you a quest? Because that is Kingdoms of Amalur right there. And playing it, it was like going back in time, and it was only like released 5 or 6 years ago, something like that.
Yeah.
Already things are, with The Witcher 3 and things like this, things have come along so far in the RPG from this old game that I found it quite encouraging, actually. It let me trace the progress of the RPG in such a short amount of time.
Because it was made over quite a long period, wasn't it? It was kind of like a passion project of the baseball player Clint... Yeah, I can't remember his name.
I can't remember his name either, but it's an extraordinary story. I think it belongs to an American state now somehow, because like the project imploded so drastically that I'm pretty sure the state reclaimed the assets.
The studio was based in Boston, and it was very, very highly subsidized by the by Boston Council or whatever.
This is a classic story of someone who wanted to make an MMO and then settled for an RPG instead, which is why it's so fucking huge and why it's so bloated as well.
And why it's got exclamation marks.
Absolutely, and all that stuff. And the zones feel a little bit like MMO regions. I'll be a bit prettier, actually. It's not a bad-looking game. It's got some, like, it's bright and colourful and kind of lurid in the way that it's fun to just kind of go into a cave and see those bright blue fungus everywhere. You come out and you're in this kind of verdant green place. It's got that nice kind of flow of colours as you go through the areas. And as long as you don't do any side quests, just go through the main quest. Don't do any of the bloat. and just kind of enjoy your weapons and settle on the style that you want to play. It's actually a really surprisingly satisfying RPG that you should definitely pick up in a Steam sale for about £3. and it's good value, I'd say, if you're looking for that sort of game.
There was something else I've been playing. Have you tried 35mm?
Millimeter. No. What is that?
It is a miserablest post-apocalyptic Russian kind of... Well, it's pretty much a walk-em-up. And it's incredibly atmospheric and kind of weird and really interesting. I have kind of enjoyed it.
Yeah,
really
had an experience. Right.
I've had an experience, yeah. It's very grey. It's very Stalker-like. Very much that atmosphere. A journey with these two men who don't say an awful lot to each other, all in Russian, but with English subtitles, which are very badly translated, which just adds to it for me. And it's just, it's got that little promise to it where you just don't know quite what's going to happen next, where so far it's been pretty much just walking from place to place and just going in houses and coming out again. It's actually quite open levels, but has this charming thing. If you go too far into a forest, it'll say, "You don't have to go far."
That's the nicest phrasing of that turnaround message, I love it.
So you go back again and it's like, oh yeah, I'm pleased, this is bounded, this is nice. But it has, like, it's always suggestive that it might ask you to do something deeper than just exploring, or at least it has that capacity, which actually makes it feel quite a lot deeper than it actually is, which meant it gives it sort of extra substance. I recommend it because I think it's cheaper generally, but in the Steam sale, it was super cheap.
Superb. So intense.
Are you showing to me that, you are a big fan of House of the Dying Sun?
Yes. Well,
I believe your recommendation of it was just to type its name in capital letters repeatedly.
Have you been playing it?
Yeah, so I talked about it a bit last week, or whenever it was, on the pod. And I didn't get on with the combat as well as... Or I didn't find the combat as satisfying as I expected to, because I'd heard Graham talk about it as being like the sort of... the one space game where it feels like FPS combat, where like you're flying a gun, like, virtually. And I think they've changed something where like, the ship you start in isn't the one that he's played with or something. But I was interested to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I it's a lot more... I suppose I was expecting... So I was expecting it to be like X-Wing, TIE Fighter, like a set of very, you know, like a strongly narrative-driven set of kind of... encounters, like one after the other, each of them quite intricate. And while the encounters are quite intricate, like, you know, things happen within them, I played kind of them all on the easy level. So you get to choose to play the level on one of three difficulty settings. And I went through a lot of them on the first difficulty settings and I was just like breezing through them. Like,
yeah, it's easy mode. It's genuinely easy.
Yeah, it's super easy. And it also makes you think that kind of, I'm not really doing anything special. Like I'm not really exploring. You know, you're upgrading your craft as you go along. At one point you're then able to have wingmen, which you can then actually fly as and also command. It's in a similar way you could in X-Wing and TIE Fighter and stuff. But it all felt really slight and I thought, it's not the deep kind of space combat sim that I was kind of expecting it to be. But then I tried it on higher levels and like it comes far more alive. Like there's much more threat and there's much more going on. The feel of the actual combat, I did like it. I think I got quite a lot. I felt there was feedback. I think space combat games are really hard to make.
Yeah. The thing I said about last time was basically, although I didn't like the combat that much, I was playing it mostly because I was curious to see if this would be the only space combat game that I like at all. I've never liked one. There are plenty of space games I've played and that, like, got something out of, but it was never the combat. The combat's always been like, just dragging my fucking hull up and up.
Yeah,
to track the thing and then press the button.
Yeah, the, It made me think back to why I liked TIE Fighter in particular so much. And I think it was really the sort of, the structuring of the missions, I think, the way that you got this sort of, they would start investigating, scanning some canisters, and then something would happen, like, oh, there'll be some escaping sort of rebels on one of them, so you have to go off them. And then suddenly, like, a rebel kind of capital ship jumps in, and then, oh my God, everything's changed, and you're having to react to it, and you might be having to defend things. And while the combat in itself isn't particularly interesting, actually, the speed at which you need to sort stuff out so you can then zip off over to the other side of the kind of the area that you're fighting. Mm. But I think that's where it was kind of active for me. It was like an imaginative act rather than a kind of an action act.
Yeah, Free Space 2 is amazing for that as well. Like, Free Space 2 kind of picked that up and added the spectacle element where the capital ships, like, you're fighting Nebula a lot of the time. A capital ship just emerging out of the fog, firing lasers at another capital ship that is bigger than your ship. And you became this insect. You weren't important really in that. It's like just you had some objectives, but the bigger things were fighting, and that's what was important. And that's a magnificent feeling that I've not seen recaptured really. They sort of touch on it in House of the Dying Sun because they've got this battleship that appears. Which is the kind of, for me, like, I thought, oh, it's the Spelunky ghost of this game. That's what comes to wipe you out if you're here too long. And that generates a kind of a really interesting pressure. And I had some good experiences of kind of warping out at the very last second as it was kind of approaching. But I think the biggest problem for me with the game was I kind of enjoyed the kind of dogfighting to an extent, but it felt like a lot of the complexity was in the loadout system. And I don't care about loadout systems. I don't find them fun.
I didn't get far enough to even get any options for that. I was just always given a thing, and then I would click to, like, edit loadout, and then it's like, you can only have this gun. You can only have this hull. You can only have the ship.
Yeah, but, I mean, once you complete other missions, you unlock options for weapon options.
Right.
And so some of them are hard counters for certain types of ships that you encounter in missions. So I felt as though on the harder difficulties, I was going up, and as long as if it's just, like, equip the right thing, then just fly forwards and kill it with the thing. And there's a really neat thing where you can pop into the map and actually control your forces like an RTS. I never really felt the need to do any need to do that. It felt like just pointing them forward, pushing them forwards would do the job. I'm not sure if
I did a bit, but only on certain missions where I was just finding myself, where you're flying towards some enemies, and because you've got no cover in a space.
Yeah.
Space shooters, they just pummel, you just get wrecked because you're having to fly straight on, to an enemy. And so I was kind of putting in my wingman as kind of like
fodder.
Meat shield.
That's a good use. Looks beautiful though.
It's really gorgeous.
So the first time I played it was in VR, and I said last time, but I said, oh my God, like six times before I ever got into the game.
Can I just say that font? That is like the perfect.
Yeah, I don't remember the font.
Because it's interesting, like, the story is actually really slight or very hard to kind of get an appreciation for, because it's a line of text,
and there's some drum beats.
Yeah, some drum beats, but it's all in, for me, the font, because it's a bit duny. And
not directly, but like sort of stylistically is Law and Order, where like every sort of act break has a dun dun. I think you and I have been playing Overwatch as well, Alex.
We have.
Have you played Overwatch, Tom?
A little bit, but
I've never seen you in Overwatch.
I hate people. People in this game have been kind of dicks a lot, so I've just stopped playing.
Yeah, they have.
I haven't actually seen that many, but I play mostly with, you.
Yeah, we tend to play together wherever possible, and that's. It's still not, like, it's pretty rare that we're playing, like, all of us making up the whole team. Like, we always have some people on our team who aren't people we know. And I was hoping, so they recently introduced competitive mode, which I have not played and do not intend to ever play, because that's, like, a perfect description of everything I don't want from Overwatch. And I was really excited about it. Like, at first they announced it, I'm like, oh, I don't care about that. And then I realized, oh, wait, I don't care about that. And lots of people do. And those people will go to that mode and never come back. And I never want to see those people again.
Naturally filtered.
And so I was really excited. Like, oh, cool. All the, like, the assholes who bitch about other people's class choices are going to go off to this other separate mode and I'll never see them again. No, that hasn't happened. They're all still there. They're all still in quick play. I don't know. I guess they play both, or maybe they, those people got too frustrated with people's class choices in competitive mode and decided never to play it again. But they're all still there in quick play. It's quite nice when you are with, like, a bunch of friends, and in that situation, even if you lost, and even if the other people in your team are, like, bitching about, like, oh, someone needs to go support, but they're not going to support themselves, that is mitigated greatly by the fact that you're all on voice comms and just laughing at this idiot, and...
I quite enjoyed where we've had randoms kind of being random.
Yeah, it's generally tends to be more of a joke than a... Like, if you're on your own, even though you don't take that person seriously, even though you don't really, you don't respect their opinion, it still kind of stings. There's something just, it becomes a hostile environment. Yeah. Whereas when you're with friends and you're talking about it, it's kind of just funny and you can brush it off a lot more easily. There was a person, I wasn't really involved in this, but I still felt bad about it. There was a person who was like, two of our group went Symmetra on this map because we knew, like, they tried it before and it worked really well. Like, you know, each Symmetra can play 6 different turrets, and so you can have 12 different turrets, and if you put them in really sneaky positions, it just destroys people. And then one of the people who wasn't in our group was like, oh, 2 Symmetras, or only 2 Symmetras, and then we ignored him, and then we lost. I think someone said something snarky to him, and then he replied, like, fine. And I thought he was just saying, like, okay, I'm done with this argument. But then I looked at the roster, and he'd gone Symmetra. He's like, fine, I'm all in. Let's all just fucking be Symmetra. And then we lost. And then, we were saying in chat, like, oh, man, 2 Symmetras is too much. We should have fewer Symmetras. Why didn't somebody say something about that? he did not get the sarcasm and was like, come on, for fuck's sake.
That is like a little meta thing to the whole game, I think.
I wish there was, I don't know, I think that Blizzard have done the right thing in that there's competitive mode and there's quick play mode. And in theory, the quick play mode should be like the kind of sandbox where you just play whatever you like and have fun. And people don't treat it like that. People get annoyed about class choices. And I've also seen, like, because of quite popular posts on Reddit saying, like, rebelling against the people who tell them to calm down when they criticize other people's class choices, saying, like, oh, sorry for actually, like, trying to play the game, or I didn't realize you were only allowed to actually try and win in competitive mode. But the thing that bothers me a bit about it is that the game has its own, pre-built statements about what it thinks a good team is and what you thinks you need and what it doesn't.
So you
pick the classes and it tells you, oh, you need more tanks or you don't have a sniper or whatever. And inevitably that system is not perfect. It's quite good. I think it's a good thing to have, and they've done a decent job with it. But it's just taken as gospel by players. Yeah. And so if you have 2 of any class ever, someone will say, oh, you don't need 2 of them. But sometimes you do. If the enemy has, like, 3 Bastions, maybe you need 2 Genjis.
The 6 Tracer technique.
Yep, I played a 5 Tracer game and we won in, like, a minute and a half.
Wow.
And I think there are loads of situations where, like, multiple ones of the same class is viable. Sometimes it's the best thing. Sometimes it's not the best thing, but it's still a fun thing to try and is at least as good as a balanced team. Sometimes even when you're not countering like a specific imbalance in the enemy team, having more than one sniper on defense can be fucking great. If you're like a couple of good snipers on defense can be absolutely devastating. And having more than one support can be great. And having like, you know, 2 Reinhardts defending a Bastion is
pretty
strong.
It's about reaction and it's about making interesting plays.
Because the game has just sort of created this gospel of what's right and what's wrong.
Mm.
People back it up as well. They've assumed that what Blizzard say must be correct, and then if you do that thing, they'll criticize you for it. Which kind of sucks. But I have found that, like, lately, I don't have that many games that are actually frustrating. Like, TF2, I played it loads, and I played it with friends a lot, but we didn't really do voice comms that much. We play in the office sometimes, but 90% of my time in TF2 is playing without using a microphone to talk to anyone. And that was, you know, every multiplayer game is like good 50% of the time, and it's what the other 50% is like when you're losing. And I found with Overwatch, I'm having more and more games where, yeah, we lost, but actually it was kind of fun anyway, or it didn't feel totally unwinnable, or...
Yeah, matches often go, like, because of the overtime system where you're often, you know, I get the feeling that where you're sort of capturing zone, the counter can often, like, suspiciously go up fast when, you're, you know, one team is on sort of 80. Well,
apparently it's completely broken for competitive play, because the way it works is something like if it's in overtime and then someone from the other team gets on the cap, it goes back up to 100% or something, or 99% or whatever. Like, okay. instead of slowly adjusting to that change, it instantly adjusts to that change. And it means in competitive play, what really matters is just touching the cap every now and then. As long as you have someone touching the cap every now and then, you can't lose.
Yeah.
And so the team composition is like two Lucios, two Tracers, two Winstons. Tracers because they can get to the front line fastest, Lucios because they can speed everyone else up, and Winstons, I guess, because they can also get to the front line really quickly fast, and also like technically tanky. And then Tracers getting on and off the cap, like no one can really stop them doing that. You can kill the Tracer eventually, but you know, if there's two of them and there's other classes running around, they'll always just get to the cap, and that just keeps resetting the overtime counter and keeps resetting it, and then no one can win. It's really strange. So I don't know that much about how competitive play works, but there's so many complaints about kind of close games, like games where it goes into sudden death. And that's like if you have... So on a single capture point map, it, you know, someone has to win eventually, but it has that overtime system, and that's kind of broken in that way. On an attack-defend map, I think that overtime system is not a problem, but it's very possible for one team to win on attack and then to lose on defend. And so both the attacking teams have won and it's basically a draw. And then it goes into sudden death, and that sudden death can be any map. It's the same map you already played on, which means that it's not necessarily a capture point map. It can be, or not necessarily a King of the Hill map. It can be a attack defend map, and it's random who attacks and who defends, and opinions. Like, when it first came out, everyone was like, ah, oh, this is such fucking bullshit because whoever's on defense can't possibly win because... Oh, sorry, whoever's on attack can't possibly win because 2 minutes is not enough time to attack. It can't be done. And it's bullshit. So whoever loses the Koitos loses the game, and all our rankings are affected and everything. And now the complaint is exactly the same, except everyone says that, oh, it's completely impossible to defend that. Attackers will always win.
And I think so, Blizzard will know all the statistics.
Yeah, I mean... I suspect the players are right that this... I mean, doing it on an asymmetrical map is obviously just flawed.
Like, yeah, true.
The whole problem is that... But I find it so weird that they're not more willing to just call a win a win. Like, if two teams both won on attack, the one who won fastest on attack is better. That's a better win. Like, if you...
Or you actually have draws in the game, because despite competitive mode, it's still not really a game... That's really a competitive, like,
yeah.
Competitively.
Yeah, yeah. So are you saying, like, they should just call it a draw?
Yeah. Just go for draws. I mean, I know that I can appreciate that unsatisfying.
I would pick a difference in time that is big enough that you could say that was a full win. Like, if someone wins 5 minutes faster than the other team, that's probably as good as actually beating the other team. And then from that to zero difference, you'd scale down what the win is. So whatever the points they get for the win, you kind of just multiply it.
The trouble is then you're incentivizing people to say, oh, we've taken too long to do this, let's just give up for the rest of the round, if they already know, you know, at what speed.
Well, they still don't know if the other person's going to win. I suppose if the second team who are attacking know what time the original people took.
And then they know.
But then they'd still be working to minimize their loss percentage. If it is proportional, they'd still want to be as close as they
could. Or do you just do a best of three?
Anyway, that's probably not worth thinking about that much, because never going to play it. It's interesting, though, because they obviously wanted this game to be both casual and competitive, and its launch was so positive. Like, the reaction was just so unanimously positive, and even, like, people had class complaints, but they also had, like, total faith in Blizzard to fix everything, and I've seen multiple people, like, come out, post on Reddit and stuff, coming out and just saying, like, Jeff Kaplan is brilliant, and it's so nice to see him, like, responding to all our complaints, and he really feels like he's in tune. And then this competitive thing is the first thing where, like, people are, because they've said they're not going to change it this season, how it works, And so they're kind of saying, like, all these problems you have, they're just going to be problems for a while.
Mm.
And now people are kind of losing faith.
It's hard. I mean, it's only been out for a month.
Yeah, I think I'm probably a bit more mature to lose
more than a month.
Yeah.
Should we do questions?
Let's do questions.
Yes.
Jon Torkelsen says, I have a few questions and observations that I'd like to hear your views on. He gives three, but we're only going to answer one because we don't have time for everything. I've heard that some of you like sword fighting. Here is my problem with sword fighting in games. The swords, or maces, or whatever, always pass through enemies, at least unless blocked. And that is really not realistic, if you think about it. Do we just accept this because we've already learned to accept clipping in video game graphics? Is there a better way to represent sword fighting that would actually work in-game? I kind of agree with this. It's certainly what bothers me about a lot of, like... It tends to be more in console games than PC games because there are a lot of console games that are kind of, like, big slashy games. Yeah, slashy, like, games. Bayonetta and...
God of War.
That genre, I don't know about Bayonetta itself, but I often see, like, you know, a trailer for a big new game that everyone's excited about that I've never heard of, and I look at it and realize, oh, it's a console-only series where the main character swishes a big sword or weapon in a big arc that leaves like a big white trail and it hits like 19 enemies at once, but there's no sense that it really hit them in any real sense. Mm. So yeah, I kind of agree with that. Obviously, like, actually simulating the full physics of how a blade hits a body and, you know, doing true, I don't know, animated physics ragdoll-y like reaction to that would be difficult. There have been like tech demos where I remember there's one like the G-Man's face, and wherever you click, it rips apart his face. His face like goes into a horrible gibbering wreck around it, and it's like, well, okay, we don't have that in games. Soldier of Fortune had like pretty precise deformation of faces and stuff. You'd need something like that, I guess.
I think you've got the lightsaber problem, like where lightsabers are kind of meant to cut through anything.
Yeah, so lightsabers are the one where, like, I feel like making a lightsaber game is easier than making a true sword fighting game because lightsabers are meant to go through everything, and all you have to deal with is how that thing falls apart or whatever. Whereas swords should be stopped at some point. Like, if you hit an armored person with a sword, maybe you cut through the armor, or maybe you cut through some of his flesh, but it doesn't go all the way through. Whereas a lightsaber, you can just say, like, well, it passes through anything, it isn't a lightsaber. And yeah, I think the physics of it are too difficult, and then also probably the game mechanics of it are not worth it, because if every sword blow that hits, like, cuts off a limb or completely cripples that limb, you basically won the fight at that point. The rest of the fight doesn't really matter.
Slash.
And so, yeah, it's really just like first strike wins. And that's, I think that's generally true of like bullets as well. You know, you get shot in games a lot, and your reaction to getting shot is nothing like a real person's reaction to getting shot. A real person's reaction to getting shot is they fucking stop fighting.
I think, like, as long as there's reaction, like, I think that Dark Souls and Bloodborne really get a sense of sharp things being swung because the reaction of the thing that you're hitting is, there's a real kind of lurch back, and they're often show wounds as well, like slashes across them.
Sound design of Bloodborne as well, and those games where there's kind of real squelching, kind of
spray of blood.
Yeah,
I guess in a sense it's actually like closer to my heart than I realised, because I
spray. Now we're talking about sprays of blood.
I love blades and killing people, but also, like, you know, this is a thing where I'm never going to make a game where you swipe a melee weapon at someone and it goes straight through them and they lose 10 hit points, right? I've always tried to avoid hit points anyway. Mm-hmm. And Heat Signature is a game where it does have melee weapons. It already has like wrenches and stuff in it, but we're going to do swords and we're going to do other different types of melee weapons. And the way we get around this is that every single melee hit always kills somebody. Like, they don't survive it. So we don't have to model exactly what happens to them. It's just they're dead. So
You kind of have to have a... The thing about this swipey through people thing is that when you press a button to attack, there has to be an element of guaranteed damage to that for a combat system often to be very satisfying. Whereas with actually swinging a heavy thing at a fleshy lump, like, there's all sorts of intermediate outcomes that could happen. Like, you clipping their arms or kind of slamming into a hip or something, or into a piece of armour or not. And that, I think, would prove deeply unsatisfying as an actual combat mechanic.
We need the gang beasts of sword fighting.
So do you remember... So this brings to mind Mode 7 games.
Yeah.
First game, which was called Deliverance. No, yeah, yeah, Deliverance, yeah, Determinants, yeah, which you played way, way, way back.
Yeah.
How, that was a sword fighting game.
It was a sword fighting game where you were both also flying, so you were like, I don't know what the story was exactly, but you were both just literally like floating in the air and you would swoop towards each other and swing the sword. I think with the mouse, I think it was like sort of precision.
Oh, was it one of those
thing?
Kind of white sweeping the
mouse? I couldn't swear to it. It was, I was really new at PC Gamer and they came to the office and showed us this and I didn't know who they were at all. And I mean, I guess there was nothing to know. They were the people who made Determinants. So I didn't know what Determinants was. And I quite liked it. I thought it was kind of cool. I liked the idea of like, I don't think it was super big on like sword fighting. I think you could get it in like a clash where you had to sort of, you know, win the struggle or whatever, but it wasn't about the sort of intricacies of fencing because you were flying. So the distances involved were enormous and it was like, just how do you lunge and who's lunging at who and that kind of stuff. I thought it was quite cool, but they, have consistently referred to it in subsequent talks and stuff as a total failure. Just kind of written it off.
But then, yeah.
I mean, compared to Frozen Synapse, it's nothing like as good as that.
Yeah. And it also brings to mind Neil Stephenson's game Clang, which was meant to be very much like it was. I remember the Kickstarter campaign was all about his frustration with games that depicted swords and them not being, you know, realised in any realistic way.
And now it's
canned. And that went got canned, yeah. So
shout out to Silver, which also had the kind of click drag mouse sword fighting thing, but in a stodgy RPG.
Well, Die by the Sword is the one that, you know, the oldest one of mouse driven sword swinging. But even
was
that-
it though? Because Ultimate Underworld had a mouse draggy.
You just sort of clicked on the area of the screen that roughly corresponded.
Oh,
to
you
the...
had to. You had to sweep it. You had to.
Did you?
Maybe I did. Maybe I was very excited.
Die by the Sword was like very analog. It was kind of like, you know, every twitch of your mouse actually physically moved your sword in the space, and whether how much damage you did was actually determined by the physics simulation of like how hard did this object hit that object.
Was it satisfying, Tom?
No. I mean, it kind of was. I played it a lot and I liked it a lot, but it was, you couldn't, even once quite practiced with it, I couldn't really show you a clip of 30 seconds of me playing it that didn't involve some extreme awkwardness or weirdness and your sword passing through people, because like the point of that, if you can fully control the position of your sword, then that also means that when you fail to do a really decisive strike, you've done a kind of like feeble strike on them and you've just kind of waved your sword at them, but they can't actually stop the sword going through the body, I don't think, because then your mouse would be out of sync with it, I guess. And actually, it's kind of interesting because we're going to have the same problem in VR. Like, VR will be capable of doing incredible things with close combat, except ever stopping your blows.
I had this.
You never have it.
Yeah, I tried a demo where there was first person combat and I was fighting a giant skeleton and he had his shield up. And there was the great moment of like stabbing over his shield, like reaching over and actually going down. And it kind of registered in that way.
Oh, wow.
But it didn't feel like, like you say, there's no resistance. However, it did feel like I was brutally killing a thing. So on that level, it was really quite successful.
So the worst of all worlds, really.
Yeah.
Not mechanically convincing, but still deeply disturbing. Rob Young writes, "Dear Kale and Quinoa, I recently wandered through impossibly elaborately set quasi-interactive radio player map every bit of Gone to the Rapture, and left my mind meandering there for quite a while, as I believe was probably the intent. Loving the score of then-Chinese Room co-director Jessica Curry so much, I investigated what she is up to at the moment and discovered that she has left the company, in her public farewell letter revealing that she had been diagnosed with some manner of chronic degenerative disease. I'm sure it's no great spoilers that a story called Everyone's Gone to the Rapture has some elements that tie in very heavily to the personal experience of chronic disease, and this discovery thoroughly changed the depth of my reading of the game, allowing the enormously powerful component of empathy to come through, until I realised that I had no idea whether or not Curry had actually been diagnosed at the time of making the game. Eventually, I decided that it didn't matter, that my empathy with the characters in the story had been improved regardless of whether or not they were intended as a conduit for personal expression of shared emotions. So I guess my questions are these. Do you allow yourselves to see the creator in the work? Have you been fooled by this? Have there been any instances where learning more about the creator of the game has changed your feeling about the game itself? Is Phil Fish okay? Ta very much for reading, Derek." Wait, it's signed Derek, but it says Rob Young at the top. Okay, it's Derek. Forget Rob Young.
I think it's quite an interesting point. Like, I don't think you're ever fooled by like a context of a game, like, because your reading of any game or book or film, whatever is valid, whatever you think, you know, it might be wrong or not shared more specifically with by other people, including the creators, but it doesn't make it that you've been fooled.
Yeah, you listen to that U2 album and you think, oh, that made me feel this way about this thing. Bono isn't coming into your house to go, that's wrong.
He might do.
Wouldn't put it past him, frankly. But no, they're quite right. It's interesting. Have you ever learned something about a creator that has tainted the works that have that you've enjoyed or kind of affected the way you've
thought about things? The Witness springs to mind in that it's not that...
We love Jake Long.
Yeah. I do like him. And I like the game.
Great pop star name, isn't it?
But he's just said so much about his philosophy of game making that The Witness fails at, that I think I probably am harsher on The Witness for it. Like, if it was someone who'd never said anything about game design and they made that game, I'd be like, oh yeah, it's pretty good. Like, I like a decent percentage of the puzzles. Some of them are really good. Some of the sort of sequences are really brilliant at teaching you things, but there's also a lot of dross in there. There's a lot of time wasting. There's a lot of repetition. And, you know, that's the thing I'm used to in games. But because John Blow has been so vocal and so specific, like, never waste the player's time, never disrespect, never ask them to repeat themselves, never ask them to, like, do this. I was just kind of bewildered by how much of that there was in the list.
That's an excellent choice, because I literally said on the podcast when we were talking about this that my experience of the game would have been improved by not following John Blow on Twitter, and for slightly different reasons, actually. I think it's because I expected a greater level of depth or complexity to the themes of the game, and there is some of that, but a lot of it is kind of fluff.
I think it's a game's better the less you know about it, quite the better. Like, that goes right down to where it comes from.
Absolutely.
Because like a friend of ours who I had no idea they had a PlayStation, you know, and like much less had bought The Witness. And she played it with her son, who goes to the same school as my son, and she was talking to me in the playground, and like, oh, I've been playing it. Yeah, I don't know what it's called, can't remember. Really colourful, full of puzzles. And could it be The Witness? And she said, yeah, we absolutely love it.
Yeah,
and
like, that's cool.
And for them, all these philosophies are completely irrelevant.
Yeah,
purely experiencing the game and like and having a whale of a time. Yeah. So good.
It'd be funny, we'd have had that experience and not been so.
There's also like the way it's presented really in the game is very like a theme park and like a sort of a destination that you just kind of go and you wander around and you do some stuff if you can do that stuff, and you encounter a lot of stuff you can't do. And I wonder if I would have been more receptive to that if I hadn't been thinking of it as this kind of, I assume it's going to be a refined selection of perfect puzzles from the mastermind Jonathan Blow, who, you know, not even just, even if I'd never followed him on Twitter, just from playing Braid. Braid was a really brilliant showcase of like every puzzle is its own unique thing and every puzzle is saying something, and some of them I don't like, but only a couple. And even the ones I don't like, the reason I don't like them is because they're different to the puzzles I did like. They've changed something, and John Blow likes to explore a puzzle space fully, and I don't think that always works out, but at least they're all different in their own way. Whereas The Witness, I just felt loads of them were just the same as the last eight I'd done. If I had no idea who made it, I just stumbled across this thing and just found like, oh, there's so many cool puzzles in this thing. And the fact that there were a bunch that aren't that cool wouldn't bother me, I don't think, that much.
It's interesting that the influence of a game on the games that the developers go on to make. I felt this with the creators of World of Goo. After playing World of Goo and just having such a magical experience from this unheard of developer, then their subsequent stuff was a disappointment because it didn't recapture the same sense of magic, even though, I mean, had its own.
Maybe all us developers just change our names right after we release. Because I'm probably going to hit this with Heat Signature, because I don't really know for sure, but it's not going to be a single linear narrative thing that you play through in 3 hours for sure. And Gunpoint was, and so a bunch of people who really like Gunpoint and then played this thing only because they like Gunpoint might have that complaint. And if I was completely starting from like anonymity, I wouldn't feel obliged to put any story stuff in it, but I kind of do feel obliged to put some kind of story stuff in it if I can. I guess the questioner is talking
about positive.
His example is about a very personal thing he knows about one of the creators of the game and how that influences it. And I can't think of anything like that. Filthfish is making Super Hypercube now, and loads of people really like that. It sounds to me...
So that's a PlayStation... Oh, is it only PlayStation
4?
Yeah,
I think it's PlayStation VR exclusive.
Yeah.
And it's a VR game where like you have a weird shape in front of you. And if you've ever seen that Japanese game show where like a wall comes towards the contestant and they have to make themselves into a certain shape to pass through the gap in the wall, it's that, but you are rotating a complex conglomerate of cubes to try and match the 2D shape that's coming towards you. And it's in VR, so you... I think the shape in front of you kind of blocks your view and you have to kind of like peer around it to see what's going on. And gives you everyone I know who's played it says it's great.
Yeah, I've heard that too. Yeah.
Jamie Elvin writes, quick two-part question. Why don't you talk about console games? And with the new, more iterative console cycles of Scorpio and Neo, is the distinction between PC and console still relevant? And if so, how long do you think it will remain so?
Well, we just did talk about some console games.
So yeah, that's all the time.
he elaborates a bit on these questions to say, it's not uncommon for one of you to enthusiastically start talking about a console game, then quickly back out of the conversation upon realizing it's not a PC game. I know the pod was born out of PC Gamer, but are there any other reasons that you remain focused on the PC platform? I think, it's like the main platform of interest for all of us. But also, one of the reasons it seemed worth doing was that there just aren't that many PC gaming podcasts out there. There are millions of general gaming podcasts.
Don't be rude, Tom.
Generic is insulting. But it's interesting, like, the two of the other podcasts that I recommended in the last time we were asked for podcast recommendations are Idle Thumbs and Video Games Hot Dog, both of which do cover multiple platforms and both of which are anyway PC focused. Mm. Both of them just happen to have a bunch of people who are really interested in the PC stuff. And in Idle Thumbs' case, they veer into console stuff a lot. And in Video Games Hot Dog's case, they actually veer into mobile a lot more than they veer into console. But for me, it's like making the podcast platform specific is kind of a reassurance for the listeners. Like if you don't have a particular console, like if you just don't have, a console that can play Bloodborne or whatever, and you listen to a podcast where they talk about Bloodborne a lot, then that whole section is going to be maybe interesting to some extent, but past a certain point, you're like, okay, I get it. It sounds cool. And I can't play it. And so, like, just if you have a PC, then you can probably play almost everything we ever talk about here.
If you've listened to the podcast for any length, you know that we all play games on consoles as well and love a lot of games on consoles. Mm. Some brilliant stuff out there. And we've always kind of meant to pop out little specials that maybe talk about console games independently. We just literally just not found the time to do it. But I mean, like we went mad for Destiny and Bloodborne last year, and Bloodborne especially still feels like we should do one. But we'll definitely bear that in mind for future. If people want to hear our opinions on console games, we'll kind of pop it out as a side thing from the podcast, but we'll always keep the Great Crowbar PC focus thing.
Yeah. His other question was, do we think the distinction of PC and consoles is still relevant given that consoles are now doing incremental upgrades?
I think politically it's incredibly more relevant than ever. The reason being that if there's anything about PC, it's the fact that it's an entirely open platform. And right now, arguably, that distinction is being challenged.
Yes, by Microsoft's vision of the kind of the Windows platform that spans both the Xbox and PC, but ultimately you don't have to have Windows on your machine, and at the end of the day you could go and install Linux, you could look at other alternatives, and those alternatives will always exist on PC. I think no matter what Microsoft does, there will always be these kind of rogue OSs that will exist and kind of allow people to experience games on the PC.
But there's always that danger that you won't get to play Far Cry.
Sure,
And,
I mean, there are already some games that have been announced that are Windows 10 exclusive, right? And are they Windows Store exclusive as well?
There are some, like Gears of War will be.
Right.
I'd expect almost all of them to be, surely.
I remember reading
Sea of Thieves, and I really like the look of Sea of Thieves.
Yeah, it looks really fun.
I'm sure Phil Spencer said something about, like, We will be releasing these on Steam as well, or other platforms as well.
Yeah, they have said that. Like, they, when he spoke to us, he was quite open about the fact that just there are so many sales on PC, on Steam, sorry, compared to other stores, that it's almost kind of just
it's suicide,
financial madness not to put your games on there in some way. But then Quantum Break came out, and that was a Windows Store, and so we don't know yet precisely what. How they're going to approach that, and what maybe games they think that their big games will actually go over to Steam. The stuff they don't expect to do so well, like Quantum Break, will be store exclusive. Who knows?
I like those other platforms updating themselves. To me, does not reduce the barrier between them and PC. It's the barrier is still the same. It's still you can't play those games if you have a PC, and you can't play PC games if you have that.
I think it's encouraging. I think there's still a massive separation between the two, but it means that the technological baseline at which people will be developing games over the next decade will be constantly increasing.
Yeah.
So we're going to see better and better looking games, and games that could do more as a result of this. We won't be tied into a decade-long technological standard that often holds back what developers can do, as we saw in the last generation. But the open worlds we've seen since the generational shift, so it's like The Witcher 3 and like the remastered GTA 5, are just extraordinary. And you know, as long as technology progresses, then we can expect to see more of that.
And also, given that they'll be, you know, they're both Xbox One and PlayStation 4 are so similar, like architecturally so similar to a PC, that it means that PC can expect to get those games, you know, with a degree of quality and, you know,
stability
and whatever else, that's, you know, it's easier for them to be converted.
Yeah,
or for them to be developed on PC and then
put over, yeah. It's encouraging, I think.
Yeah.
Carlos Sol Rojo Salazar. Definitely didn't get all of that.
I think, wasn't that an evil character in something? Resident Evil 4.
Oh, really?
That's a console game, we don't talk about that.
God, brilliant bad guys in Resident Evil 4.
Actually, no, that's totally on PC, isn't it?
It is.
He writes, Dear Podcat, in a previously alive and subsequently defunct, although later revived, podcast...
But the PC Gamer Podcast. It's not Voldemort. It's not PC Gamer Podcast.
You guys had dedicated episodes for spoilers. In this new podcast, you barely talk about spoilers, and I think this is due to this fact. Some discussions of value regarding the quality of storylines has been lost. Have you ever considered making episodes where you talk about spoilers again, making a spoiler sections in episodes? I think the latter option is good if... what you don't want is having an episode not everyone can listen to. Having a 20-minute section listeners who don't want to hear spoilers can easily skip would not be too intrusive, I think. Cheers from Mexico. I think having a 20-minute section in the middle of a podcast that adds spoilers in would be a pain in the ass for a lot of people, because if you're like cycling and you're listening to this thing and then the spoiler section comes up, it's like, oh God, I've like, come off the road to avoid spoilers for this thing. Maybe having it at the end.
I think we'd pop it out into a different thing, I think.
Yeah.
Just have a 20-minute or 30-minute, like, extra bonus pod.
Our failing really is not that we haven't thought about this. We've for many different games in the last few years, we have said, oh, we should totally do a dedicated podcast for that, or we should totally do a dedicated spoiler podcast for that. And then we don't get around to it because we already do this one night a week, and it's pretty rare for us all to have, like, another night a week.
Hmm.
But I think, yeah, I think we should probably think about is just doing, like, the spoiler podcast in the same night and just doing, like, a general podcast and doing a spoiler podcast the same way.
Yeah, and to be honest, if you're listening and you like that idea, then let us know, because we have no idea how many people would really enjoy that stuff. So it's really useful for us to hear feedback on ideas like that.
Yep. It's quite tricky because there's a, like... it's rare for there to be this one game that we all have played that we all want to talk about. Yeah, it doesn't have to be everyone.
But... me and Chris and I could have talked about like Destiny from forever. I think we could generate enough
time. Yeah, this ties straight back into the console question of like anything where only a certain percentage of people will be interested in it might as well be a separate pod.
Yeah, sure.
Cone Brummels writes, sorry for your name, for my pronunciation of your name. Good day, weighted companion cubes and zero-point energy field minute predictors. When the Portal trailer... okay, this doesn't make any sense. When the Portal trailer, I was very excited for it to come out. Perhaps when I saw the Portal trailer, I was very excited to come out. I was very happy when it did and loved it, but was somewhat disappointed when it did not have the stay in the air a long time puzzles. Are there any games you loved that were disappointed when you came out? I think he's referring to, like, there were some puzzles in the original trailer that were just, like, nuts. Where I don't know if, like, the puzzles themselves weren't in the game or if it just wasn't necessary to do that solution. But there was a puzzle in the original portal trailer that was so cool. I analyzed it until I totally understood what was happening. And then when I totally understood what was happening, I realized it doesn't make sense. Like, the solution that they do is not necessary. And it's a thing where the player, like, fires themselves across a chasm and then shoots a portal below them and they drop down into that portal, and as they're dropping down they put their exit portal next to it so that they drop back out of that same floor going upwards, and then when they're going upwards they face backwards and plant a new portal, and then when they fall back into the portal they just came out of, that then causes them to be launched across the room. And when you look at the puzzle setup you can see that they didn't need to do that. There was a way simpler way to do it. But I was so impressed, that was the thing I loved about that trailer, and was so excited about it that I made my own portal level where you do have to do that. And it was going to be, I was going to make a whole episode of Portal and have my own storyline for it and stuff, but I only ever got around to making that one puzzle, and it was just like this certain barrier that comes down from the ceiling that means that the only way to get past it is to shoot this portal into it, then drop down, and then
became so contrived.
Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of ridiculous. It did kind of work though. I sent it to some people and they played it and they got it and it panned out. My name for that chapter was Judos, because GLaDOS stands for, what is it? Something G, life form and operate and disk operating system. Is it general life form or I can't remember. But Judos was just a disk operating system. Where are we now? Okay. Diffraction Man writes, we always laugh at game villains having no plan other than to break everything and then run away. Are there any game stories that seem stupid at the time, but given recent events, seem like something that people would do?
I think Crusader Kings 2 and anything to do with Brexit.
It's all coming back, isn't it? It's great, the actual factions dividing, eating each other, and, you know... It's great.
Assassinations and
all the good shit.
It seems pretty good to me that all the villains resigned after doing their thing. Like, it's better than them sticking around. Like, okay, yeah, you can also criticize them for cowardice, but like, thank God they didn't stick around and see it through. Like, thank God it's going to be chaos rather than actual malice.
Imagine if Sauron had fucked off that video after he forced the ring. It's like, oh well, I've done my bit. It's fine. He's going to retire now.
Follow-up question, because the machine spirit of this iPod is sending things before I'm done with them. I was hearing Tom Senior talk about the Dawn of War. Talk about Dawn of War recently, and how Warhammer is about huge battles. I think maybe that's true for the tabletop, but Dawn of War 2 felt like playing a story from the 40k books. I was always impressed by the mechanics, but I loved how each piece of the loot had a story to it, more than I'd seen in any other game. And how there would be remarkably deep conversations between you and your squad members between missions. It was an RTS that did RPG things better than a lot of RPGs. So what other games have excelled in areas you didn't expect them to? Dawn of War 2 Retribution felt broken mechanically in ways that suited the lore and were fun. You could buy units and got refunded the cost when they died. But the Orc war boss could replenish units for free, by shouting loudly of course, so you could generate a massive army by constantly sending units to their deaths. It felt like cheating the game in a way that you suspect was intended. Have there been any other games where you've exploited the mechanics of in a way that enhanced rather than ruined the experience? Hope you're having a lovely day. Regards, Peter. I think there are games that have excelled in areas you didn't expect them to. I don't know if we have answers to that, but I enjoyed his story about that.
Yeah. I think there is something that is a game that does strike me, Disgaea, which is on PC now. But like, it's a game that is all about gaming it. Like,
so for games that you've exploited the mechanics of in a way that enhanced rather than ruined the experience.
Exactly, yeah. So this is a game in which you it's all about leveling and leveling and leveling, and you can level yourself and you can level your weapons and you can level everything in it. And the numbers of damage that you cause go up exponentially, so you get sort of vast numbers coming out. It's basically it's a game about increasing the numbers, and it's all about breaking it in order to do that. In order to level up weapons, for instance, you go inside them and then play levels inside the weapon, and as further you get in these levels, and these levels are infinite, they go on for as long as you
want. Wow.
And the further you get, the more powerful the weapon becomes.
I can't play this.
And it's insanely deep and incredibly long, and you know, and it's about basically breaking it, and you can get these incredibly sort of virtuous circles of abilities playing off each other, and you know, with these kind of light shows of stuff happening and numbers.
And this is on PC now.
It is on PC, yeah, because it was a PlayStation 2 originally, I think. But yeah, it's on PC now. I think the conversion was a little bit janky, but it's totally worth it.
Yeah, I would say mostly Final Fantasy VII. I think the favourite RPGs I've ever played have offered the truly faithful a way to break the game.
Yeah.
And that's your reward.
There was a Knights of the Round one, wasn't there, where you could kind of repeat.
Chain it. Well, there's the mime materia. There's the magic spell mime. And actually, Knights of the Round wasn't the most efficient way to exploit this.
Oh, really?
So Knights of the Round is this extraordinary summon, and it takes like 9 minutes to unfold. So you have to watch the enemy. It's like you could do it on a tiny grasshopper if you want to. And then these knights kind of emerge out of the ether and slice it into pieces. And all the knights at the round table come and kill it and deal like 9999 damage. And then you have the person next to them, who just casts mime. And they don't have to have that summon. It just repeats the summon again. So it's another 9 minutes of footage. So it's going to take you, like, you know, 25 minutes to kill this grasshopper. Whereas the savvy Final Fantasy VII player will know that quad slash and mime is by far the best thing. Because all quad slashes is they go up and punch them four times for 9999 damage each punch.
What?
And so you're dealing, look at that damage output. It's much better. It's much better. I mean, you have to do a fuckload of stuff to get that. But that's one of the great joys I took from that game, is like understanding the system and then exploiting it in that way. And I wish more RPGs would offer people ways to break the game through devotion. Yeah. The power of devotion.
Zed Fang writes, what is your favourite character arc in a game? My pick would probably be Mordin in Mass Effect with his struggle regarding the Genophage.
It's a great call. Mordin's story was the one that really got me in the Mass Effect series. By the end, I didn't really care about Shepard's. I cared about Shepard, but I didn't really care about the overarching kind of Reaper threat stuff. But Mordin was the one.
Yeah. There was... I'm playing The Witcher, as I said before, but Bloody Baron, obviously the kind of the high point, low point, high point of Witcher 3, where he takes you on an arc of kind of, well, depending on which way you play it, but redemption or further misery, depending. And like, that game's all about taking you in directions that you didn't expect. So I'm playing Blood and Wine at the moment, expansion that came out recently, and like the main story in that is just so much fun. Like, it's just going off in all sorts of directions, and it is one where characters you meet, you just don't know, you really don't know what they're going to do and what they're going to come. Well, I like the fact that your character, like Geralt, is very steady within it all. You know,
yeah,
very
he's a straight man, so everything that happens, isn't
which is perfect.
Yeah. It's what I think is great about Blood and Wine in particular is that it's allowed to be a shorter story than the main quest in The Witcher 3. So The Witcher 3 has this pressure to be a world-ending threat, and it has the pressure to be a 40-hour story. Whereas Blood and Wine, they can do like a 10 to 12-hour thing, and that's just a far more healthy place for a story to develop and a better length for character arcs to happen.
Yeah, because in the main story, what you got was kind of these sort of chunks of stories, kind of, and it did feel, oh, we're in the Bloody Baron bit, and then like that will now end, and now we'll go into another chunk, like chapters, which did feel a little bit kind of, for all the individual richness and sort of gratification, they did feel a little bit artificial.
Yeah, for sure. What I enjoyed about the Bloody Baron and a lot of the Witch 3 characters that you spend a lot of time with is that it's not almost not the arc of... There is an arc to the character that you've encountered, but there's almost most of it is about discovering them layer by layer, and what you initially think he is, it isn't what you think he is. Then you judge him in a certain way, and then things happen to make you judge him in a different way, and it becomes synthetic again. That would be meaningless if you haven't done it, so I apologise for 30 seconds. But no, The Witch 3 is brilliant. Just amazing quest writing.
I have not played The Witch... Well, I haven't played the Bloody Baron quest in The Witch 3, but I've heard so much about it from so many different sources at this
There's
point.
There's no need to play it anymore.
yeah. I mean, this is not to... I'm not being victimised by aggressive spoilers or anything. I read a bunch of articles that said, this spoils this quest, do not read this. Right. And I was like, oh, no, I'm probably not going that far. I just want to find out what it's about.
I think if you've missed out on The Witcher phenomenon, or you feel like you don't have enough time to play The Witcher 3, I'd recommend waiting and picking up The Witcher 3 and Blood and Wine in a sale. And what you can do with Blood and Wine is just create a brand new Geralt, a new character from scratch.
Yeah, maybe I'll do that.
And you could go in and there will be some major quest spoilers, but nothing too hideous. And you'll get that contained adventure in this contained place. And I think that's a great way to play The Witcher 3.
There's barely any callbacks to the main.
No, they're very careful about it. Yeah. They're very careful not to actually spoil what happens.
Because they can't guarantee whether you've played it or not.
Yeah.
Because I in general, the reason I haven't got super into the Witcher series is that I much prefer RPGs where I can create my own character, or where my character is neutral enough that it doesn't really matter that I have to play as one person, and I can just kind of impose my own personality on it. Whereas Geralt, kind of, in the main quest at least, has a pretty strong personality already, and you're this guy, and if you don't like that guy, then it's not
How
as effective.
How can you not like Geralt?
Let me tell you the ways.
But, it's interesting with Geralt, though.
To hear you guys refer to him as like the straight man in the Blood and Wine thing makes me more interested in that.
I mean, he's the straight man throughout. Like, he's kind of...
My problem was, like, weary. I really hate characters who are glorified. I hate this even in TV as well as games, where, like, the protagonist is just this kind of, like, ultimate hero god where every woman wants him and every man wants to be him. Mm. And Geralt certainly has that in the main game.
It's interesting because, like, with the women, that's true. But everyone hates him.
Yeah, the women, a lot of them kind of... I mean, I think...
There were lots of scenes in the main game where, like, okay, these people hate me, but then they get completely humiliated and destroyed. Like, it's just immediate. And that's the same thing I don't like in TV. Like, you know...
Yeah, sure.
I kind of got off House when, like, House was not only adored and glorified by this set of people, but then this small set of people who didn't like him got completely crushed and destroyed and humiliated for not liking him. I don't like Geralt. Last question is from Jamie O'Donnell. No, Jams O'Donnell. Jonathan Sutcliffe. Whose Twitter name is Jams O'Donnell.
A man of many aliases. Man of mystery.
Which one of you is leaving 7 feet around Bath? There's been a second seven foot near Bath.
Did you read this?
What?
Yes. No,
what? Really?
Yeah.
In a sense, the other foot has dropped.
My first question
was... What if
was,
it's two left feet?
That's it. That was my first question as well.
Surely
I was like,
not.
Is it
Surely
a complete set?
Same
yeah.
Set.
So yeah, there's a serial killer on loose in Bath, it seems.
Or foot remover.
Or a person who has removed their own feet.
That would be an extraordinary...
it says something about...
crime drama.
Does this say something about us, or does it say something about Bath, that we're not... scared, just amused.
It's the only thing that's happened in like 10 years.
I listened to a good Stuff You Should Know about a particular, I think it was Vancouver or something, where this bay where severed feet kept on washing up in trainers all the time, and they were like, why is this happening? And the local police were like, don't worry about it, it's what happens. It's like, why would you get this many severed feet in this place? And it turned out to be about the science of the way people disintegrate after drowning deaths and what gets carried where and stuff like this. And so, yeah, go listen to that if you want some gruesome, fascinating.
So the feet were just kind of like rotting off.
Well, presumably, like it protects it from getting.
Well, quite right, exactly right.
The
ankle would rot and the trainers would go off, and certain slipstreams would carry into certain areas. fascinating.
Really, and well, Vancouver was
apparently so. Obviously, Bath. not a sea facing. these haven't been carried by the wind, so there's a far more sinister plot afoot. Or, as people have speculated on the first foot, that it was like a drunk med student who was having a laugh or something like that,
who found
their way into the morgue and decided to nick a foot and put it in a field.
It does feel like whatever the explanation for the first one is, that's also the explanation for the second one.
Yeah, it definitely feels that way. Anyway, nothing to do with video games, but that's the... if we're all dead and footless, within the next few weeks, you'll know exactly why.
Well, I'm fucking off to Sweden, so I should be fine.
Yeah.
I'm just going to a cabin in the woods with a thing where I had to sign a disclaimer saying if I die, it's not their fault.
I liked also that they asked you to take safe. Two mobile phones.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a mistranslation or something, but they seem to suggest I need a spare mobile phone.
Yeah, that's because the killer will destroy the first one. Keep the second one in your sock and your trainer, and then you can call for help.
They're sick of watching horror movies where there's like, oh, all their mobile phones are out of signal or whatever.
Anyway, so soon to be dead Tom Francis. farewell from the podcast.
Live. You're all going to... I'm going to come back, you all have no feet. I'll be fine. There are a couple of things we should mention. One is I forgot to say that we are recording this not in our usual studio, and so if the quality is not as good as normal, that's because we're using a different mic. So don't complain, because we don't care. The other is... I don't think anyone else have played Inside, right?
I'm going to play this week.
But that is out it's probably out at the time that you hear this. I think it's probably...
I hear it's fucking amazing.
It is, yeah. And everyone says it's great. And also everyone says that you should read nothing about it before you play it. So the fact that we can't talk about it is actually not a disadvantage.
Maybe that'd be one of our pop-out podcasts for people who...
Yeah, those are the first spoiler casts.
Yeah. Although I won't be on it. Goddamn.
Well, just go and come in by the internet. You got the internet in the woods.
Yeah, we've never done that before. There's not any technical reason we can't do that, but it's a bit different. I suppose maybe if it were like a spoiler cast, it could work. It's like a one-off thing.
Yeah, we'll think about it.
Anyway, if you'd like to send us questions, you can do so at questions@crateandcrowbar.com. We also have a forum at crateandcrowbar.com/forum that has a question sub-forum. You can follow us on Twitter. We are at crateandcrowbar there. We have a Discord channel, which you can only really get at via our website, because the link is too long to say out loud. And you can follow us individually on Twitter. I'm at Pentadact, P-E-N-T-A-D-A-C-T. Alex is...
Rotational.
Pretty easy to spell. Tom is...
PCU Ludo, which is L-U-D-O.
Thanks for listening, everybody!
Goodbye!